This is podtech.net. I'm Jason Lopez at the Dow Jones VentureWire Consumer Technology Ventures 2006 conference in San Jose, California. The new flavor of the month in consumer electronics is video. To be precise, video over the web. One might argue that was established last month when Google bought YouTube, but there are still big questions. Has user-generated content really changed the tastes of viewers, or has YouTube garnered an audience simply because it has the most readily available content? Can Google control the video landscape, or will the power of rights holders determine what we see and hear on the internet? This panel tackles that question in a slightly different way. You want to hear me and see me, right? It starts with Wall Street Journal reporter Lee Gomes introducing the panel.
The panel comes at this from many different perspectives, and I want to take a bit of time to introduce each of them and kind of have them explain sort of who they are and why they're here and what their sort of interests in this are. Tech, why don't you start and to tell the audience sort of, you know, where you've been and what you've done, and we're going to talk about some of the things that we talked about.
Why I'm relevant, okay? So name is Tai Kwan. I'm currently an operating partner at Texas Pacific Group, which is famous for its buyout group, currently the largest private equity fund in the world, but little known fact that we also have a significant venture and growth equity fund, which is where I spend most of my time helping invest money. Prior to my arrival at TPG, I was the CEO of Friendster, the social networking site. And before that, I had a six-year career at Interactive Corp, running technology operations, marketing, and sales for various IAC companies, most recently as EVP of Product and Technology at CitySearch, which, of course, is known for its editorial as well as user-generated content. And prior to that, I was one of the founders of Hotwire.com, the online travel agency.
What's your we were talking earlier about some of the events in this space, and we were talking about YouTube as people tend to talk to, and you're telling sort of an interesting story about what happened when you kind of first heard about this a year or so ago and what your thoughts were and, you know, the accurate predictions you made about about its future. So share that story because I think it's illustrative of a lot of the issues here.
Yeah, so just as a bit of background, one of my friends is currently a CEO of Break.com, which is not really a competitor to YouTube, but a YouTube-esque type of site for teenage boys. It's a little bit like the show MTV show Jackass online, where, you know, people submit videos of them biking off of cliffs and, you know,
how did they deal with the liability issue?
And doing crazy things. So I was enamored with the product idea. I thought it was a great user experience, and especially the way that they had the flash-based player aggregating all this video content was really, I thought, clever. But when people asked me, VCs I was associated with asked me, well, do you think this would be a good investment? I frankly couldn't answer because my perspective was it was a pretty binary deal. It either was going to get tremendous scale and therefore build brand and deep reach into a very valuable demographic, or it was going to be, you know, a small service that was followed loyally, but maybe not having an interesting revenue model. So I think the prediction that if it gained enough scale, it would be acquired and would be interesting to a lot of players was true. But I think the big question that remains and everybody's contemplating now is, so now that Google has acquired it, what revenue future does it hold, and what kind of advertising products is it going to innovate and bring to bear to the market? So that's something that I'm still questioning myself and, you know, attentively looking for.
That's a question I won't be answering this morning.
And Tech, do you have a prediction about how it's going to go either way?
Well, you know, I think that the YouTube phenomenon tells me two things. One of them is obviously the amount of video content that's being consumed online is just unprecedented historically. For the first time ever, you have people under the age of 20 spending more media time online in front of a browser and sites like YouTube and MySpace than even in front of the TV. And so I think that, you know, if you look at through your horoscope 5-10 years from now, I mean, I think that it's not a far reach to believe that all the ad dollars that are being distributed through the traditional media channels are going to follow online. I think the big question is in what form, right? Because the internet is a very lean-forward experience. It's very interactive. People have the ability to rewind, fast-forward, skip content, select content, and as opposed to in traditional media channels, is much more of a lean backwards experience. So I think it's really a matter of what kind of advertising products are going to be innovated on top of what's already a very at-scale platform for media distribution.
Okay. I'm going to jump to the end of the panel. Steve, you tell the audience what you do and what your site does, because there are obvious similarities to YouTube. And in answering that, I'm especially interested in what why you think YouTube became the phenomenon that it was, because from far away it seems so random that different sites, for example, like MySpace, why one hits and one doesn't. There seems to be a lot of sort of... It seems to be much like boy bands where things just sort of come out of the blue for reasons that aren't apparent from far away. Maybe if you look up close, there is a reason, and it was sort of predictable. But so talk about what you guys do at Rever and your perspective, how you would tell the history of YouTube.
So Rever is not a boy band.
But, it does have boy band videos, though, right?
but we do have boy band videos on the site. So Rever is a video monetization service. We are not a destination website. We are a place where content creators can go and process their video and allow it to be released in the wild across the internet. A social network page, browser, email, what have you. And everywhere it goes, Rever is tracking that video and delivering a dynamic ad into that video. And what we do in that instance is we share the revenue with the content creator. And we share the revenue with the content creator in an equal split, and we also share the revenue with the syndicator, the person who is expressing or presenting that content on their MySpace page.
Steve, is it fair to say that it's YouTube with something going back to the people that uploaded the video in the first place or created the video in the first place?
Yeah, at its very essence, yes. I think that YouTube is a place you go to discover video, and Rever is a place you go to release your video into the wild. And there are slightly different metaphors being played out there, and I don't see ourselves as quite the same, and nor do I think they. I think we're in two different businesses.
And in terms of traffic, if I went to the traffic metering sites, how would you guys rack up compared to, I know there are a bunch of people in this space now, how would you guys, where do you guys stand?
Well, that's really where the difference is. 98% of our traffic is happening off of the Rever website, right? So people come to Rever.com not as frequently as people see Rever elsewhere. We're getting lots of traffic in other locations, but we don't focus our business product on the actual destination site. Uh-huh. Now, just to speak to why I think your question was why I think YouTube hit at the moment it did. I think a combination of luck and content and a willingness to push the envelope on copyright and some technology that was pretty easy to use at a moment where people had spent quite a long time being prevented from having easy access to content. So I think their timing was excellent and lightning in a bottle.
The fact that they have so much material on their site that's problematic from a copyright point of view, how important is that to their popularity? If everything that was copyrighted was just would somehow never make it to YouTube, would it still have been the phenomenon that it was on headbutt videos or the history of dance?
I think that to a large degree, their success came from the ability to go to YouTube and discover any type of content you wanted in any category by any creator. And I think the suggestion that the vast majority of the audience was looking for content they had heard of before is probably a good suggestion. I think there are serious and robust and as yet unresolved issues around copyright that a lot of people, some on this panel and others, are really faced with on a day-to-day basis. Rever actually has a different approach to the problem. We vet every piece of content that enters our environment before it is put into the library. Excuse me. So there's a video patrol that is very, very vigilant around who owns the content that's entering the Rever syndication library environment.
So I won't find Comedy Central videos or...
with their permission. You will not without their permission. Not once, not ever. We've gotten one cease and desist notice since the service was released in beta.
So is there there's someone between the uploading and it's not automatically posted by virtue of being uploaded?
It is so not automatically posted. It enters a staging environment where we verify the ownership of that content in every case. Mm-hmm.
And how many people would you say are competitors with you right now?
I'm sorry?
How many people would you say are competitors with you right now?
In precisely the model that we're executing.
Expand against, the definition a little bit.
Broadly defined, hundreds. Narrowly defined, syndication network, video review, sensitivity to content before it enters the network, rev share with the creator, best-of-breed content creators like Lonely Girl, Ask a Ninja, Zay Frank, what have you. Using the service, there's nobody who touches us.
Hunter, how is Google now has two video properties. How are you guys positioning them, and what am I supposed to think as a Google user about Google Video and YouTube? What's the positioning there?
Sure. I mean, I think as we've said, and the deal is still yet to close, so I can only really speak for Google Video. We're very excited about working with YouTube. We think that both Google Video and YouTube serve distinct purposes for the user and continue to operate both services as customer-facing websites. I think from Google Video's perspective, we started the project because we anticipated video was going to be not just a destination site, not just an advertising medium. I mean, it was really going to be as ubiquitous as text across the internet. And what that means is that there's going to be a lot of it. There's going to be the ability for anybody to create it. And there's going to be the ability to reward creators who are bringing high-quality video into the world. And so for us, it's about comprehensiveness, about being able to monetize videos on behalf of the creators, and about having a user experience that allows individuals to find video, maybe if they're explicitly looking for video, or perhaps video being the right answer to their query. So a lot of people come to Google and Google properties not necessarily looking for entertainment or looking for video, but looking for answers. And I think increasingly you're going to see video being the right answer to a query, just as a web page or an advertisement might be today.
Do you think the kinds of videos that are going to be on YouTube are going to be sort of will they remain different from those that I would get at Google Video?
I mean, I think YouTube, Google Video, a lot of the larger video sites, you're starting to see video that, in terms of topic, kind of mirrors the web in general. The breadth is only going to increase. I mean, I think one of the things if 2006 has really been about user-generated content as the funny viral video, I think 2007 will broaden the definition of user-generated video to include informative, educational content that's about more than just an opinion and a laugh, and has different types of value that can be recognized in different ways.
Danielle, you're the only person here who's not from a company, not from a company that's actively in the market. You sort of look at the market and think about the market. One of the really interesting things that's happened in the video space in the last 6 or so months is, you know, as YouTube became more important, other companies, and I'm thinking of Yahoo now, clearly are making a play to grab the time that people are spending in front of their computers, wasting time looking at funny videos. Any thoughts on how successful that's going to be? Well, first of all, so what is the market of people, you know, looking in? How much time are people willing to spend at their computers, not being particularly productive, but looking at funny videos? And how up for grabs is that? And if people are spending that time on YouTube now, to what extent might it migrate? You know, to what extent can you sort of people sort of grab that brand share, that mind share?
I think in general, the PC is being perceived increasingly as an entertainment tool. It may not be the friendliest entertainment tool. It may not be the, you know, preferred entertainment tool, particularly for watching, let's say, a full-length feature film. However, we are using it more and more, whether it's for music, whether it's for video, television, news, et cetera, as well as, you know, personal photography and creation of content and communications. You know, voice communications leveraging the PC is a relatively new phenomenon. So as a tool, we are spending more and more time on it. As far as video goes, there's been, you know, as been mentioned and I think demonstrated by this panel, a huge pop in video consumption at the PC. Our data shows that roughly a third of folks that are online are using video services at least once a month. And then within that, obviously, you have your folks that are using it multiple times a week and spending at times hours on a given site. You'll see averages all over the place from 4 minutes, which is actually pretty good, to several hours for serious enthusiasts. Our research also shows that it tends to skew on a lot of these, quote, I guess more along the lines of things like YouTube versus, let's say, iTunes, which is just about commercial content. In terms of some of that more user-generated or user-uploaded, tends to skew a lot more male. I would say in some cases even 2-to-1, but in other cases just a slight edge over female. So behaviors are shifting, and I think it's all for all sorts of reasons. Part of it is because people are looking for something different. Part of it is just because it's free. Part of it is because you're just spending time there for other reasons. You're checking your email. You're doing some web surfing. You're on a blog. You discover video. You then want to find more video, and it tends to be something that I think perpetuates additional usage once you've actually found something that you've gotten value out of, whether that's entertainment, knowledge, et cetera.
And my impression has always been that with a site like YouTube or with like video, people will start, and in the first sort of weeks of the thrill of discovery, they'll spend lots of time, but it sort of craters after that, or it levels off to a more reasonable amount of time after that. Is that do you think that happens, or does it become a full blown addiction? Or
really, I think there's definitely some people that would consider it addiction. But yeah, I think that for a lot of folks, there is this sort of initial entrance once they discover it, either through sort of a viral sort of, hey, check out this video, and then it starts to pan out. I think for the majority of users, it tends to be something that they use in addition to many other sources. It's not replacing most people's TV viewing. In fact, many cases, people are actually, with their laptop in the den, watching the TV while they're also, checking out these videos. So it just goes to show you that, it's not just multitasking, doing multiple things at the same time. It's consuming multiple video sources at the same time. As far as its longer term, my take would be, I don't think you can count out the web. There's just too many great things that it does in terms of offering, quote-unquote, on-demand capabilities, giving you niche content that you're not going to find elsewhere, finding things that, I think that were mentioned a moment ago in terms of not just entertainment, but in the future, educational, how-tos, and so forth. And so in that sense, I think it will become increasingly important for more people to use. But as far as, people walking away from their TV sets, that's not going to happen anytime too soon. And then the question becomes, how can I move this content from the web to other places? So while my laptop might come with me to a lot of places, portable media players, bringing it into my living room, those sorts of things we're just starting to scratch the surface on. And I think once we get those fixed, and we'll see what ITV does with iTunes and so forth. But as we start to see some of those solutions become more user-friendly, reliable, support more broader codecs and DRMs, I think at that point, that's when internet video really becomes a commonplace, sort of a leveling off of frequency of use as opposed to a leveling or a falling off.
Lee, one of the questions you alluded to in terms of discovery of video and people's watch, it's sort of what I kind of have separated into the first video versus next video question. First video versus next video. So when people come across their first video, it's largely because they found it through a search engine or a friend referred it to them. There's a tremendous amount of sort of viral pickup in, hey, check this out. And I think what you see a lot of the sites starting to try to figure out now is how to get that person to watch the next video in that session. Because when you start to talk about monetization and bringing your user in, do you just throw a popular video up next? Do you try to personalize it? Do you try to show related videos? If you look at what some of the destination sites have been doing recently, it's all about trying to get you to share the video you just watched and click over to watch a next video. And I think that will evolve to become more useful as opposed to just a billboard that promotes.
And so what are some of the strategies, different strategies that people use to do that?
Some of the things they allow you to do are sort of more video from this creator. So Steve, sort of mentioned some of these creators they work with who they're not one and done type of internet superstars. They're actually building a following. And you want to know if you found this one video, you might want to see more things that they've created, or you might want to be made aware when their new video comes online. Very often, with individuals who are sort of more the tastemakers or the scouts. So you have this morass of incredible amounts of videos being created. And there's definitely the creators are important, but also right below them are the folks that I sort of think of as the scouts. And they're the first people to sort of watch and throw this video out to their friends. And if you find that you enjoy their taste, you might want to see other things that they've enjoyed or other things that they'd recommend. And then finally, there's more implicit and explicit personalization. So what does a site know about you from your habits, and what might you be interested in based upon your viewing history, or what are videos that are related to the one you just watched from an algorithmic standpoint?
Right. What's the chance that the content providers are going to get smart about this and try to cut out, you know, search engines or other disintermediaries, and, you know, people will know to go right to Comedy Central or right to CNN or right to, you know, Jib Jab, and sort of not stop off at a video search site. As the web evolves, is there a chance that that might happen?
Because I think video is going to be very much like text or images or anything else that you find on the web, I obviously think search plays a really large component. That's not to suggest that every individual who wants to watch video will start off at a search engine. I think you'll just see that behavior is very similar to the web today, where if you're generally looking for information or you are otherwise trying to find something that you particularly know exists, you'll start off at a search engine. If you know you want video, you might start off at a video search engine. And if you know that there's a particular Daily Show clip and you've decided that Comedy Central is the best place for you to find that clip. And I don't believe it's going to be a world of exclusivity. I think there's going to be, just from my work with content providers, there's a lot of interest in distributing that content to multiple places. But if you indeed sort of Comedy Central is your, and, you know, and their player is your viewer of choice, you know, then you just may start off a return there.
No, go ahead, Steve.
Just as a brand offering, I think Hunter's exactly right. The content owners want to see their content distributed out widely. There's also the benefit, the kind of added value of bringing them into their own environment. So the brands will build out, we believe, extensively against their own brand names and their own destination sites. But they'll also want to proliferate the content out as widely as possible. That's how the internet was built.
Like, what are some of the technology issues involved in video build out, and to what extent would a site like the big guys like Google, to what extent would they have a significant competitive advantage just because they have the infrastructure to push out all these bits compared to, you know, name a second-tier person?
It's a good question, and certainly there's a lot of answers. Just piggybacking on some of the things that were just said now, I think I definitely agree that video distribution is going to be, at least for the foreseeable future, dominated through search as the gateway to it for a couple of reasons. One of them is, you know, I think that the world has voted and they've decided that Google predominantly, but search in general, is the way they're going to navigate the web. So even very, very strongly branded companies, you know, when I was working at IAC, we owned some of the most popular, well-recognized brands on the internet, and these sites still generated about half their traffic from Google. So,
well, are people searching for the site, or are they doing what I do, which is I basically use Google or Yahoo as sort of a URL bar. I'll let them take me there because it's easier to type.
It's a combination of both, and it depends on which property at what percentage is attributed to each way. But the point is that people find Google in particular, but search in general, to be a very convenient way to organize their information. So they effectively don't have to bookmark anything. They just go to Google and type a query in. So I think if, going back to your question about the technology's role, I think one important role is how to index all this video content. With HTML and text-based content, it's very easy to actually build a crawler that goes and searches for keywords, and there's all types of algorithmic activity that goes on. But at the end of the day, there's kind of a law that's followed on how to index things and you know, judge their relevance. I think for video, it's a little bit more challenging because you don't have effectively crawlable content. And so there's a lot of metadata that you're going to have to rely on. There's a lot of kind of user input, maybe ratings or tagging that comes into play. And so inventing a technical way to properly judge relevance, I think, is going to be a big challenge. And, you know, obviously Google, with, you know, their army of PhDs and infrastructure, is well positioned to be the leader there. But, you know, I think innovation can come in a lot of different ways. And that's kind of a big area that's unsolved for me. I think the second big role of technology is the monetization of this video content. So everybody assumes that ad dollars is just going to start to flow online. And I think that to a certain degree that's correct. But going back to what I said earlier, I think that there's going to be ad product innovation that drives a lot of the spend as a result of online video being a very interactive channel where, you know, the TV experience of watching a show and then taking a 30-second break and having an interstitial ad is not going to work as well online. So, you know, inventing ways in which to put advertising content maybe in line with the viewing experience or, you know, around it. Who knows? I don't know what the product will look like, but just like the invention of AdSense and contextual text links interstitially interspersed through a blog, I think something like that needs to happen in video to properly monetize all that content.
The best thing about the technology platform and, you know, what didn't come up is just the serving of video, right? So a few years ago, that was an incredible stumbling block to things becoming popular. The measure of popularity used to be how quickly do you crash a server, right? Victoria's Secret, you know, we had X number of streams and we brought it down in 20 minutes. Success, everyone. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think we're all geeky enough in this room to have received, you know, years back a link to a cool video on somebody's site. You'd click over and bandwidth limit exceeded. Right, so there are all these things that could have become much more popular, could have become the hits that you see today, but they were headed off at the pass by true technical limitations. And, you know, those predominantly, I think, are gone, not just at the Google scale, but smaller companies able to operate at scale to deliver this content. And what now you're left with are sort of the next order problems. You're able to deliver in an unparalleled fashion, so how do you monetize, how do you find all the things that are now out there?
How the quality of the video experience right now is subpar. It's sort of like that old thing about the dog that dances. It doesn't dance very well, but you're just impressed that it does. And certainly compared to what you can see on a TV, I mean, people would never settle for the video quality they're seeing on a computer on their TV. It doesn't seem to be a problem now. Might it start to become a problem, or do you think people will? Steve, it looks like you have thoughts about this.
I am sorry. We really think hard about this. It's our belief that the metaphor is we're in the top of the second inning around online creativity. You know, you look at Lonely Girl as a great example of this. They're having an interactive relationship with their audience. They're playing with genre and format.
Well, I'm going to talk about that, but I'm thinking mostly of just picture quality and resolution and
the resolution
and frames per second and those very technical things. Yeah,
it looks great on Rever.
I think it's to not only picture quality, but production quality, story quality, editing. It all is linked to length of video. So right now you're talking about 30 second, 60 second, 90 second clips, right? And I can watch anything for 30 seconds. I think as it, you know, potentially grows longer, I think picture quality is one of the attributes that folks will become more sensitive to, especially as it moves across devices.
Do you think that might start? I mean, people might start differentiating themselves on picture quality, or I mean, is there even are the pipes fat enough to be able to do that?
Well, I mean, I think it's less about the pipes and more about the source quality in a lot of ways, right? So you're collecting things that are coming from everything from professionals and prosumers with their new toys, all the way down to my new $100 digital camcorder looks pretty good, but cell phones and other devices, and you can only sort of upcode so much.
I would just add, yeah, sure. I do think quality needs to be a major differentiator. I mean, as we see things like HD displays get into over a third of households now, and increasingly consumers actually hooking up HD content to that, not just watching standard def on it, I think it's absolutely critical, especially if you want to make the leap of getting folks to see additional value, paying for that value because they want to get it over into the living room. I do think bandwidth is still a major issue in this country, and it's not just downloading, because you could always sort of, you know, have stuff automatically update and sort of off times and cache and so forth to help with latency, but even uploading. If you want to the point made, if you actually are able to capture because you've got an HD Sony cam, because you're a prosumer and you've edited something and it's pretty good and it's 5 minutes, and HD going upstream, I mean, you might be getting 6 or 8 megs down. I can assure you, you're probably not getting more than 768 up. So, I mean, there are, I think, still major network issues that make it a big challenge.
And what sort of how optimistic are you about those network issues going away anytime in our lifetime?
Good news is I think codecs move along faster than some of the upload bandwidth issues. I think hopefully within the next 18 months we'll start to see the cable and telcos start to see that it's not just about download speeds but offering for an additional fee some symmetrical service or at a minimum higher upload bandwidth speeds. And I think, you know, as we start to see some better competition on that front from those guys, as I mentioned, particularly on the upload, not just download, that will absolutely help to produce and sort of raise the bar and the level of quality of stuff online such that others want to mimic it and therefore make it that much more attractive for consumers to go out, find this content, potentially buy it, not just ad-supported and so forth.
One of the things that interests me a lot is what motivates people to generate content. And I want to ask everyone on the panel about this in the context of video. Steve, I mean, it seems that implicit in your guys' site is the idea that money incents people and you're going to reward them with money, and that'll become the coin of the realm will be a coin. Why do you think people do this, and what role does being paid for it play, and what role do other kinds of rewards, what role do they play?
So, excuse me. So we think it's about recognition and reward. We don't think it's just about reward. But we think that the inference of what's happening online right now is that we're moving into the realm where creators want to professionalize. And, well, some don't. Some want to, you know, cat swing from chandeliers, frat boy, weekend, stuff like that. There'll always be sort of a place for that kind of video. But if this is going to be an art form, and if it's going to drive adoption rates and people's interests in moving, you know, kind of away from really rudimentary video creation to, let's just say, slightly more sophisticated, you need to create sustainable economics around that. Because the people who are creating the content require some sustenance to keep doing it if they want to move out of this sort of base-level kind of capturing their lives with their cell cam. So we look at that from a creator's point of view as really the key to the highway, and we actually think that you're going to see a blend of kind of top-down media. You know, the idea that it's all about getting Sony or, you know, MTV to put their content into the online environment, we think that is such a small part of what's in front of us. What's in front of us are people who have created a sustainable opportunity online to make media. That media is allowing them to make more media, the results of the distribution of that media. And over time, you're going to see this is a nascent art form that's just starting to burgeon. And from where we're sitting, and I think this is true for other people on this panel, that's what's so exciting about this space. You know?
Well, it seems very nascent. I was at your site. I looked at the most popular videos, and it's, you know, the guy shaking up the Diet Cokes and putting in the mint in them and spraying themselves. What are the give me some examples from your site that would probably be unique to your site that illustrate this as a nascent art form that is
going to
move from self-expression.
I mean, absolutely. We have hundreds of people who are doing episodic content on our site, who are doing personality-driven content. Like, have people here heard about Zay Frank? Does that mean anything to this audience? Or Lonely Girl? You guys have heard of Lonely? I got one.
Really? I will tell you that. If you haven't heard of them, you will.
Yeah, believe me, if you haven't heard of them, you will. There is a captive audience for personality, drama, format. You know, we're seeing, there are guys on our site, Ask a Ninja, Fun Little Movies, sitting in the room right here, Cute with Chris, a murder mystery that's going to unfold and end at a certain date. There are people online, and I come out of the entertainment, you know, I used to run William Morris's film operation. There is a subset of creators online now that are playing with format and genre and creating kind of art. And they haven't even emerged into your consciousness. But trust me, if you're a 15-year-old kid on MySpace, you know everybody I just described. They're heroes to you. So we see a real big opportunity, and I think that that's the future of the kind of online creator environment. And I can go on and on about specific names and people who are doing this stuff. But my point is that generally, when these conversations take place, people end up talking about advertising. They end up talking about, you know, infrastructure, technology. What I'm deeply interested in, and what I think we should all pay very close attention to, is what type of creativity is being fostered in this environment. Where is it coming from? What does it mean to the future of traditional corporate media apparatus? All of those questions are profoundly fascinating to us.
I'm curious, what is the distribution of views on your site? Like, what does a relatively few number of videos amount for, you know, to more than 90% of total views? How does it sort of spread out?
The long tail.
Steve,
are you talking to me?
Yeah. Sorry.
I thought you were talking to somebody else.
No. I'm asking you about, like, where is demand on the site? Do most of the views come from a relatively small number of videos?
So a good example. Sure, that's great. So I think a lot of you saw the Diet Coke and Mentos, two guys in a white suit, right? We saw that video, right? Okay, so that video this summer is great evidence of our network. Guys came to Rever, processed the video through our system, put it back on their website. Within a matter of a couple of days, they were slashdotted. They were on Dig. And rather quickly, over the course of 5 or 6 weeks, they got 5 million or so views. 88% of those views happened on their website, on the EP Bird website. 10% of those views happened in our syndication network, which has 30,000 people involved in it as of now.
I guess I'm
Wait, this is the point.
Yeah, okay.
2% of those views happened on rever.com, which is really the distinction I'm trying to make about.
No, I understand. I'm asking a slightly different question, which is of all the views on rever.com, how many, for example, were from those guys?
Of all the views on rever.com? I don't know, 2%, 1%?
When we talk about monetization, it often comes back to sort of thinking about the videos that people are creating today and how to reward those creators. The question that I ask myself is, would monetization help new types of video be created? Would it move people off the sidelines, provide the right incentives? So before working on video at Google, I spent a few years working on AdSense, which is our contextual advertising that was alluded to earlier. As easy as anyone can just throw a few lines of code up on their website and start monetizing their traffic. And what I saw there was that AdSense was able to underwrite the creation of a lot of niche specialty content, where maybe it would have been a hobby, maybe it would have been something the person did anyway. But regardless of whether they want to go professional or not, AdSense provided a really nice bonus and helped them create content, underwrote their efforts. So when we talked about earlier, how do we make user-generated content about more than just what we're seeing today, I do think monetization, while not the only component, is an important incentive to move into some of the educational, informational. It's the type of content that I think is going to be really well matched to advertisers as well. And so sort of my question is, what makes the amateur chef decide to make a bunch of 5-minute cooking videos? Well, today she would do it if she wanted to promote her blog or was otherwise just really excited about film. But if she knew that, or somebody who knew her knew, that they could make $50, $100 a week by automatically matching various ads from everyone from Williams-Sonoma to the local restaurant against her video when it's viewed, I think you start to see a lot of that creation occur as well.
I hear that a lot, and I'm always skeptical of it. I'm not really convinced that many people make $50 or $100 a week, that it's a relatively small number among the hundreds or thousands or even millions now that actually do it, that even these sort of niche hits, much less big hits.
Absolutely today. I mean, I think the market is still developing. If you draw corollaries, though, to the contextual link and AdSense, what we see, you see many, many people making that type of money.
I want to switch to a slightly different kind of user-generated content, which is the MySpace page, which certainly last year was how lots of people spent a lot of time making MySpace pages. I know my nephews, who have no particular technical sort of expertise and would never make a video, would spend endless hours on their MySpace pages. And you were at Friendster and probably think about this. Is that still as popular a way for teenagers especially to spend time? And how might it evolve and just sort of tell the story of just people spending time making a personal page?
So when I think about kind of user motivation to contribute content, which I think is the right way to look at this, as you grow older, you need more reward to want to put something in. So, for example, for a young demographic like a MySpace or even a Facebook, people are very incentivized by just expressing themselves, showing other people and their peers what they're about. And it's kind of an entertainment, fun experience. It's like back in the GeoCities days, a lot of people created personal web pages for nothing more than just to have a web page and have a page about themselves to point other people to. And I think that phenomenon will never die. I think that need for kind of self-expression is going to be around, particularly with younger viewers. But I also think that it scales to older viewers. For example, LinkedIn is a website that, although not as trafficked as MySpace, has a very real reward for putting your information about yourself and your professional career on there. It's a good way to get connected with former people you've worked with. It's a good way to get recruited. It's a good way to get noticed and validated as being a skilled employee. Even kind of on the paid subscription model with dating sites, people willingly contribute a lot of information about themselves for the prospect of getting hooked up. So I think user-generated content, in terms of driving eyeballs and advertising and just being a form of self-expression, is always going to be around. To me, I'm more interested in how do you get user-generated content to drive more value beyond just entertainment.
Such as?
Well, so, like I said, some of the dating sites are effectively, big pools of user-generated content that they organize and enable search for. But, you know, there's a lot of other ways in which user-generated content could come to bear, you know.
To the extent that teenagers were content to spend a lot of time on MySpace, say, a year ago, mm-hmm. making their pages and putting all the ugly wallpaper up, is that still as important to them, or have they moved on to...
I think it's going to continue to be important. You know, obviously, there's only so many teens online. I think there's 170 million American unique users a month per Media Metrics. And, you know, MySpace has already, you know, probably captured the lion's share of the teen and kind of youth market. So there's a limit to how far they can grow. But I think that service is always going to be interesting to people. And maybe it's not the MySpace brand that will dominate kind of the mind share forever, but I think there will always be an entity out there that enables for that self-expression.
I think so. Before working at Google, I spent 3 years helping to build a user-created virtual world, a product called Second Life. And what we found there and what I see at Google is each generation increasingly sees technology as a creation and communication tool. So you look at the curve of, you know, have you contributed something to the web? Have you built a web page? And, you know, there's a reasonable percentage of people over the age of 30 who have done it, and then the curve just keeps on growing. So when you think about what people are doing with the MySpace and the type of projection, the type of exploration of identity, I think it'll continue to occur on social networks. It'll continue to occur in mediums like video. I think it moves into sort of 3D collaborative spaces, but it's not so much a fad as it is just how do you actualize that? What's the mechanism to tap into that kind of creativity?
Well, Danielle, kind of following on that, when people are, how do you break down, when people are on MySpace, it seems that they're doing many different things even though they're on one page. Some might be looking at pictures, some might be IMing, some might be sending email. How would you break down the different components of, for example, an experience like MySpace? And it seems that one of the implications of that is that behavior could sort of morph to something else. It could go to something like Flickr, or it could go to an IM client, et cetera. How do you think about that?
I think one of the big challenges these days is that there are so many different places to go for different aspects of that richer experience. So MySpace, a lot of times you think of as quote-unquote social networking. I'm not so sure that's how a 15-year-old would, you know, call it, but you know that's how we would use it as a terminology. Versus, let's say, virtual worlds is, you know, as just mentioned, as another place to go and sort of have this world experience and conduct commerce and I think have a very rich experience. And there's no reason why. And then you know Flickr, and now you're talking about integrating your personal content and so forth and finding other people's images and so forth. And then, you know, this notion of mashups and pulling things together. The thing I really question is how many properties can the average consumer really go to do all these things? And as we start to see mashups become more of a reality, I mean, there's no reason why a My Yahoo page, whether it's through links, whether it's just sort of embedded and or through their properties, there's no reason why they can't deliver sort of that full, robust, all those pieces in one place. And I think that's where it needs to go in order to really get people to not only take advantage of the different things you can do, whether it's messaging versus picture sharing versus checking out videos and finding old friends, but, you know, why not do all that? In some cases, maybe you want to do it in your virtual world. Why can't you check out, you know, videos there and conduct, traditional commerce there and so forth? So I think that's where we're starting to get headed and where we need to go in order for more consumers to truly, use it in a more richer way and as opposed to just an application here and application there.
One last question, I think. There's another conference going on right now up in San Francisco, the Web 2.0 conference, and that seems to be a much more sort of digerati, high-end, sort of geeky conference of, you know, RSS feeds and tags and things like that. And I'm wondering, to what extent is that a group of 100,000 users that'll sort of forever remain a group of 100,000 users, as I sometimes suspect, and to what extent will that sort of bleed down into the world that we're talking about, which seems like a much bigger market? Do you have any ideas about that?
I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the Web 2.0 community likes to talk about Ajax and, you know, RSS and all these fancy words. At the end of the day, you know, the question to ask is how are these technologies evolving the user experience online? That's the key barometer for success. And To the extent that they enable somebody to find information faster or discover more interesting content or more relevant content or make the browsing experience either faster or more streamlined, I think that those technologies will contribute significantly to the development of the Internet. But if it's a technology just for the sake of having a technology, which some of these are, then you have to question whether or not the life cycle for these technologies is going to be sustained for a long time. You know, I think the advent of Ajax, for example, is significant. I think that it allows much faster web browsing. Page loads take a lot less. I think that navigational aspects of web browsing improve. And so that's an important contribution to the Internet. But, you know, some of these other things, like RSS, it's questionable whether or not that's a significant contribution in my eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there just about everything you mentioned is either anything from a really interesting component technology to a revolutionary way of delivering content. Do they all deserve to have companies built up solely around, you know, a single feature set? Probably not.
Well, should they have 10 companies built around?
Yeah.
I forgot to ask about business plans, so we'll have to do that the next time. thanks very much, everyone.
All right, thank you, panel. Thank you, Lee.